Welcome to the Thomistic Institute podcast. Our mission is to promote the Catholic intellectual tradition in the university, the church, and the wider public square. The lectures on this podcast are organized by university students at Thomistic Institute chapters around the world. To learn more and to attend these events, visit us at ThomisticInstitute.org.
I have watched with, frankly, growing amazement the intellectual might, the enterprise, and the evangelistic zeal of you, the East Coast Dominicans, who have fostered a new appreciation and love for St. Thomas, not only across the United States of America, but in the UK, Europe, and worldwide, through your scholarship, your Thomistic Institute chapters, and your outstanding online resources, such as Aquinas 101. It's a further honour for me to give this lecture across the road from and amidst faculty of, and perhaps students of, the Catholic University of America, the great Catholic University of America, formally established by Pope Leo XIII on the feast day of St. Thomas Aquinas in 1889. Some 10 years earlier, in 1879, Pope Leo XIII had, of course, inaugurated a renaissance in domestic studies with his encyclical Eterni Patris, commending St. Thomas Aquinas more generally as the patron of schools and universities and as the common doctor of Catholic philosophy and theology. Less known, however, is Pope Leo XIII's lifelong devotion to Dante, and that his revival of Thomistic studies was accompanied by a programmatic revival of Dante studies, which in due course would lead to the only papal encyclical on a poet, Impre Clara Sumorum, of 1921. In this talk, I will first sketch the Leonine Renaissance of Dante studies and the papal promotion of Dante as a faithful disciple of St. Thomas, of Dante the Thomist, that emerged in the early 20th century. Second, I will address Etienne Gilson's pivotal role in the rejection of this view of Dante Thomist as a myth by the century's end. Gilson alleges that Dante struck a mortal blow to Aquinas and is guilty of the dual crime of shattering Christian wisdom and ruining Christendom. Okay, that's quite a crime. Third, I will situate Gilson's understanding of Aquinas' and Dante's thought in relation to Martin Grabman's study of three medieval conceptions of the relationship between theology and philosophy and between church and state. Fourth, I will show how Gilson, while drawing upon Grabman's historical research, radically reframes and, as I will argue, radically distorts both Aquinas' and Dante's thought. Fifth, having defended Dante from Gilson's accusation of a dual crime, I will accuse Gilson himself, instead, of a dual crime against Thomism, of ruining Aquinas' sophisticated discrimination between truths of faith and of reason through his misguided conception of Christian philosophy, and of undermining a Thomistic understanding of the relationship between church and state through his novel Christian social philosophy. Sixth, I will turn to the contested interpretations of Dante's own representation of St. Thomas in the Heaven of the Wise. And finally, and in conclusion, I will argue that Dante, correctly understood, may become again under Pope Leo XIV, as he was under Pope Leo XIII, an invaluable ally in the remarkable renewal of Thomistic philosophy and theology that we are witnessing again today. So, Dante the Thomist. Over the 25 years of his papacy, from 1878 to 1903, Pope Leo XIII not only made repeated references to Dante in his speeches and works, but in practical ways, he sought to promote the study and the Catholic reception of Dante. Having created a special chair in Dante studies for the clerical scholar Giacomo Poletto at the Pontifical University of Apollinare in Rome, now the Lateran, Pope Leo XIII gave him the specific responsibility to analyse Dante's thought in a Thomist key. Poletto would go on to produce the Dizionario Dantesco in 8 volumes with innumerable cross-references to Aquinas' Summa Theologiae, as well as a 3-volume commentary on the Commedia, exclaiming in its dedicatory preface, "But what does Alighieri, what does Dante not owe to you, Holy Father?" Poletto notes, among many other initiatives, Pope Leo XIII's encouragement of the Jesuit scholar Maria Giovanni Cornoldi to produce his own commentary on the Commedia, as well as other works, including the Scholastic Philosophy of St. Thomas and of Dante. Likewise, the Dominican scholar Joachim Vertier dedicated his scholastic commentary on the Inferno to Pope Leo XIII, whom he refers to as the eminent patron of Thomistic and Dante studies, inserting on its title page an image of St. Thomas in his teaching chair with Dante standing next to him listening. So that's the image you see there and on the poster. Pope Leo XIII's championing of Dante as a Catholic and Thomist poet came at a time when he was effectively a prisoner of the Vatican and when the nascent Italian state projected Dante as a symbol and model of an anti-clerical layman opposed to the power of the papacy as cattolico ma non clericale, with Giuseppe Ferrari, for example, defining Dante as St. Thomas upside down. In this context, Pope Leo XIII made 3 decisive interventions. First of all, in 1881, just 2 years after Eterni Patris, he removed Dante's Monarchia from the Index of Prohibited Books, where it had remained since 1554. Second, he reappraised Dante's distinction between temporal and spiritual power, each with its direct source in God, as in fact, in broad harmony with Aquinas' political thought and with his own social doctrine of the church in relation to the state, as articulated in his encyclical Immortale Dei of 1885. And third, Pope Leo XIII clearly distinguished Dante's reverence for the seat and office of St. Peter from his personal invectives against individual popes, while acknowledging that driven by the anger and bitterness of exile and by a partisan spirit, Dante sometimes erred in his judgments. Pope Leo XIII nonetheless insisted that Dante was never of a mind opposed to the truths of Christian wisdom and honoured him as a splendid ornament of Christianity. In the early 20th century, leading Catholic scholars such as the Dominican Pierre Mandonet and the Jesuit Giovanni Busnelli continued to chart the positive correspondences between the doctrines of Aquinas and Dante. Published on the 6th centenary of Dante's death in 1921, Pope Benedict XV's encyclical on Dante in Preclarus Summorum officially canonized then this vision of Dante the Thomist. Dante lived in an age which inherited the most glorious fruits of philosophical and theological teaching and thought, and handed them on to the succeeding ages with the imprint of the strict scholastic method. Amid the various currents of thought diffused then too among learned men, Dante ranged himself as disciple of that prince of the school so distinguished for angelic temper of intellect, St. Thomas Aquinas. From him, he gained nearly all his philosophical and theological knowledge. In the 1920s, this position was further defended, for example, by the papal Dominican Mariano Cordovani in articles such as St. Thomas and Dante of 1921 and the Thomism of Dante of 1928. Dante's crime. Over the course of the 20th century, however, This Leonine view of Dante's doctrine, as in substantial alignment with that of St. Thomas, of the Thomist Dante, would come to be dispelled as a myth or legend, and by the century's close would apparently be put to rest. And even those close to the Church's magisterium, it seems, have acquiesced more recently to this scholarly consensus. While on the seventh centenary of Dante's birth in 1965, Pope Paul VI's Altissimi Cantus continued to sustain the Church's Thomist Dante interpretive position. Dante Alighieri is a firm and faithful disciple of St. Thomas Aquinas, it reads. On the seventh centenary of Dante's death in 2021, Pope Francis's apostolic letter, Candor Lucis Aeternae, quietly abandoned it. Aquinas conspicuous only by his absence. He is not mentioned once, not at all. The reasons for this U-turn, are manifold and complex, but I want to focus on one of two scholars and exact contemporaries, particularly responsible, in my view, for the rejection of the Leonine Thomist Dante position. Of the two, the more obvious choice perhaps would be the Italian scholar and ex-priest Bruno Nardi, 1884 to 1968. His was, in the words of the English Dominican Kenelm Foster, a lifelong effort to detach Dante from Aquinas, and he openly sought, in his own words, to break down the myth of the Thomist Dante, stealing water from the Thomistic watermill of traditional commentators. However, I'm going to focus this afternoon instead on the French historian and Thomist Étienne Gilson, 1884 to 1978. His influence, I believe, was more profound in that he radically reframed not just the 20th century understanding of Dante's thought, but of Aquinas' thought as well. In 1934, Gilson, then aged 50, published a short essay entitled The Crime of Dante. The crime of Dante, because it is one, was to ruin both the unity of Christian wisdom by isolating faith from reason and the unity of Christendom by isolating from the spiritual order the temporal order, which should be subordinated to it. The greatness of the poet is not in question, but he was not the poet of Christendom. In 1939, Gilson would develop this thesis in his full-length monograph Dante et la Philosophie. Just as he split medieval Christendom into two camps, Dante also completely shatters the unity of Christian wisdom, the unifying principle and the bond of Christendom. In each of these vital matters, this alleged Thomist struck a mortal blow at the doctrine of St. Thomas Aquinas. According to Gilson, that is, Dante's crime is twofold. In the political sphere, he destroyed the unity of Christendom, and in the intellectual sphere, he destroyed the unity of Christian wisdom. One could hardly imagine a more radically opposed view of Dante to that promoted by Pope Leo XIII and articulated in Pope Benedict XV's encyclical Impe Claro Summorum just a decade earlier. For Gilson, Dante, a great poet, is emphatically not the poet of Christendom, but directly instrumental to its ruin. He is not a Thomist, as alleged, but rather he struck Thomism a mortal blow. As I discovered, Gilson's view of Dante and Aquinas is best appreciated as a programmatic departure from the clerical historian Martin Grabman's understanding of Aquinas' and Dante's political thought in his 1934 monograph, Studies on the Influence of Aristotelian Philosophy on Medieval Theories of the Relationship Between Church and State. It might sound better in German. In this monograph, Grabman sets out three medieval conceptions of the relationship between church and state and between theology and philosophy. Grabman takes Aquinas as a representative proponent of Christian Aristotelianism, which he also calls at one point Thomistic harmony. In politics, this leads to the doctrine of ecclesiastical potestas indirecta in temporalibus. That is, secular authority is subject to ecclesiastical authority only insofar as the concerns and requirements of the supernatural final end, eternal life, are involved. But secular authority possesses far-reaching autonomy in its own domain. For Grabman, Aquinas' conceptions of the rights and duties of a state in its domain corresponds to his conception of the relative autonomy of philosophy, which has its own sphere of work, its own principles, and its own method, and which is subordinated as handmaid to theology only insofar as the truths of divine revelation and faith are concerned. Aquinas' particular achievement, on Grabman's view, was an organic development of Augustine's City of God, combined with a reappropriation of Aristotelian social and political theory. This made possible a philosophical theory of the state in its own sphere, while also providing the principles for a balanced relationship between church and state, mitigating against exaggerated hierocratic claims of the papacy on the one hand, and against the obstruction by the state of man's pursuit of his supernatural end on the other. Grabman takes William of Ockham and Marsilius of Padua as representative examples of the second doctrine of Latin Averroism. In the speculative realm, Grabman associates this with the radical independence of philosophy from theology, even to the extreme of postulating the so-called double truth, whereby something can be true according to the faith, but false according to philosophy. In the political sphere, Grabman associates Latin Averroism with rejecting any dependence of secular power on spiritual power and teaching a complete subordination of spiritual papal power under secular power. For Grabman, then, it is Ockham and Marsilius who, quote, threw the world into turmoil. Grabman sees Guido Vernani as a noteworthy example of an advocate of the third doctrine of Augustinian subordination, of the direct subordination of philosophy to theology and of the state to the church, the Pope's potestas directa in temporalibus. The author of De Potestate Summi Pontificis, a commentary on Pope Boniface VIII's Unam Sanctam, 1302, Vernani is known to Dante scholars, as Grabman notes, principally on account of his polemical refutation of Dante's Monarchia. In De Reprobatione Monarchia, indeed, Vernani rejects Dante's core idea of a double happiness, one being a beatitudo politica, a happiness achievable in this life within the state, and the other a transcendent happiness in the vision and enjoyment of the highest divine truth and goodness. Instead, and drawing on Augustine as well as Aquinas, Vernani argues that each individual and the community as a whole has only one end, the supernatural beatific vision in which alone the human heart can find its rest. As Grabman demonstrates, however, Vernani does not display the same nuanced understanding of the fines medii, the intermediate ends, as does St. Thomas. For Aquinas shows the ways in which, within the framework of this ultimate goal and ordered towards it, a beatitudo politica can still be achieved through the governing activity of the ruler. For Grabman, then, Dante, like Aquinas, is a proponent of the first doctrine, that is, of the indirect power of the Pope in temporalibus. Despite his imperial utopianism and his opposition to the papacy's temporal power and wealth, Dante nonetheless clearly acknowledges both the necessity of a temporal and a spiritual power responsible for man's mortal and immortal happiness and a hierarchy of submission in virtue of the natural end being ordered to the supernatural end. As Giacomo Poletto, Pope Leo XIII's chair of Dante studies in Rome, argued, Dante's Monarchia, as I mentioned, taken off the Index of Prohibited Books in 1881, is at least in this respect in harmony with the doctrine of Aquinas and of Pope Leo XIII's encyclical Immortale Dei of 1885, just 4 years later. Right. Let us now see how Gilson reframes and distorts Grabman's three conceptions of the relationship between church and state and between theology and philosophy. Gilson first argues that the distinction between the Pope's direct and indirect power in temporalibus is in effect illusory. It seems inappropriate to us, Gilson writes, to describe the church's authority over the temporal order as indirect. Instead, the Pope exercises direct action on politics, like grace on nature and faith on reason. And as this action upon the temporal order can only be exercised in the temporal order, politics of the church must exist, conducted in the world by the church in the person of the supreme pontiff, effectively acting as sovereign. Having collapsed Grabman's first conception altogether, Gilson associates Dante with Grabman's second conception, making him the principal representative of a heterodox Latin avarism in the political sphere. It is precisely Dante who broke the unity of this Christian wisdom, professing the path of a rupture of Christendom, along which Occam and Marsilius would later proceed. Gilson then argues that Aquinas' conception has been misinterpreted, and that practically it implies that the Pope has direct and not indirect power over both the spiritual and temporal realms. Aquinas thus becomes, for Gilson, a champion of the hierocratic system and of the doctrine of the papal potestas directa in temporalibus. By collapsing the first position altogether, and by associating Dante now with the second position and Aquinas with the third position, Gilson is left with two mutually opposed conceptions of the relationship between the church and state and between theology and philosophy. The clerical hierocratic position, identified now with Aquinas, and the radical Averroist position of mutual independence, now identified principally with Dante. He writes, "The doctrinal gulf that divides the champions of the Pope's temporal supremacy and their opponents is not fixed between Roger Bacon and Thomas Aquinas, but between Thomas Aquinas and Dante." In Gilson's striking parallelism, Aquinas thereby moves in the political sphere from being, like Dante, an opponent of the Pope's direct temporal supremacy to being, like Roger Bacon, its very champion. Gilson presents Dante's Monarchia, indeed, as the very antithesis to Aquinas's De Regimine Principum. As his conclusive proof, Gilson presents two incomplete statements, one from Dante and one from Aquinas, alongside each other. "For the sovereign pontiff, vicar of our Lord Jesus Christ, and Peter's successor, to whom we owe what is the due, not to Christ, but to Peter," Dante. "The highest priest, the successor of Peter, the vicar of Christ, the Roman pontiff, to whom it is necessary that all kings of the Christian people be subject, just as to our Lord Jesus Christ," Aquinas. Gilson comments that here Dante and St. Thomas have expressed the essence of their positions, which, quote, "flagrantly contradict each other in almost word-by-word opposition." Now, following only Gilson's presentation, it would be difficult to disagree. But Gilson's presentation is deeply misleading, as unfortunately so often, and as becomes clear when one goes to Aquinas' text and reads his statement in full. So that spiritual things might be distinguished from earthly things, the ministry of this kingdom, that is, of the heavenly kingdom, was committed not to earthly kings, but to priests, and especially to the highest priest, the successor of Peter. Gilson also neglects to mention the fact that Grabman glosses these very lines of Aquinas in their proper context in terms of Aquinas' doctrine of the two ends and of the Pope's potestas indirecta in temporalibus. The administration of his kingdom, Thomas continues, Christ has entrusted not to earthly kings, but to the priests, so that the distinction between the earthly and the spiritual may be preserved, above all to the high priest, the successor of St. Peter and vicar of Jesus Christ, the Bishop of Rome. In the Christian era, there are two kingdoms, of this world and of the next, corresponding to the two ultimate ends, natural and supernatural. The kings of the Christian people are sovereign in their own domain and subject to the Pope only in those things which regard man's supernatural end. Gilson postulates a historically verifiable philosophical law that the manner in which one conceives the relationship of the state to the church, that in which one conceives the relationship of philosophy to theology, and that in which one conceives the relationship of nature to grace, are necessarily correlated. While this postulate that Gilson again derives from Grabman is arguably valid, it follows that a misunderstanding of Aquinas' or Dante's conception of one relationship leads to a misunderstanding of their conception of the others. The doctrinal gulf which Gilson identifies between Aquinas' and Dante's understanding of the relationship between church and state and between theology and philosophy depends, as we have just seen, from his radical reframing of Grabman's thesis, according to which Aquinas and Dante are alike Christian Aristotelians, such that Dante becomes instead a champion of Latin Averroism, while Aquinas becomes instead the champion of Augustinian subordination. Gilson's crime. Is it right then to speak of the crime or the crimes of Dante against Thomism, as Gilson alleged? Or might we more appropriately speak of the crime or the crimes of Gilson against Thomism and against Dante? Has Gilson dared to accuse Dante of a double crime, of ruining the unity of Christian wisdom and of shattering the unity of Christendom? Let me now instead accuse Gilson of a double crime. Gilson's first crime in the intellectual sphere is to distort Aquinas' sophisticated discrimination between truths of faith and of reason, and to undermine thereby the very nature of Catholic philosophy. For Gilson, the Christian faith had a material effect on philosophy, not only in the order of discovery, as his opponents would allow, but in the order of demonstration. Christian theologians, he writes, including Aquinas, had created a philosophy that was Christian both in its form and in its content. Their philosophy, in other words, was objectively dependent on Christian faith. For Dominicans such as Mandonnet and Sertilonge, however, Gilson's historical recovery of and advocacy for such a Christian philosophy is an essentially retrograde step to the state of medieval thought prior to Aquinas, with its characteristic confusion between theology and philosophy. Mandonnet berates Gilson for transporting the theological order into philosophy and situating Aquinas' philosophy as effectively internal to and dependent upon his theology. Likewise, for Fernand van Steenbergen, it is precisely the tendency under the name of Christian philosophy to mix up things important to distinguish carefully which leads to the severe detriment of both philosophy and theology, and to heterodoxy in Gilson's own writings. Today still, many Catholic philosophers, deformed by theology, do not succeed in imposing on themselves a strictly philosophical method. And then again, theologians, poorly informed about the precise signification of philosophical conclusions, make an unfortunate use of them in their interpretation of the revealed datum. We suffer much more from the confusion of philosophy and theology than from their isolation. While for Gilson, Dante's first crime was precisely to ruin the unity of Christian wisdom by isolating faith from reason, Gilson's first crime on this view is precisely to confuse faith and reason and to ruin thereby the hard-fought-for relative autonomy of Thomistic philosophy. Gilson's second crime in the political sphere is to distort Aquinas' understanding of the relationship between church and state, and to undermine also thereby a Thomistic philosophy of the state. In 1933, Gilson gave a series of lectures on Christian social philosophy in Toronto, in which he set out the sketch of what would in due course become the Metamorphoses of the City of God, 1952. According to Gilson, the peculiar genius of the medieval Franciscan theologian Roger Bacon gave first clear expression in the political sphere to the secret aspirations of pure theologians such as Aquinas, and which was implicit in their understanding of Christian wisdom. Thomas Aquinas, Bonaventure, Albert the Great, and Duns Scotus spoke admirably about Christian wisdom. All more or less felt that Christian wisdom secretly aspired to create a new people that would live upon the substance of wisdom even in time. But Roger Bacon is the only one who saw it, the only one who received the personal mission of saying it, and who did say it. The Res Publica Fidelium, of which Roger Bacon speaks so well, which we ordinarily call Christendom, must be acknowledged, described, defined, and integrated into its place in the concept of the Church. The, in Gilson's words, first blatant and hardly disputable metamorphosis of St. Augustine's concept of the City of God, this republic of Christian believers, if not of this world, is still in this world. And not only as the ecclesia militans, but as a true temporal people. Claiming that a universalism of reason capable of replacing faith has not been found, even where reason divides, faith unites, Gilson dismisses a philosophical theory of the state too core, insofar as it is neutral, its very secularity grounds its universality, and all humans are called to be part of it without distinction of race or religion. Instead, Gilson envisages a renewed Christendom as a united, distinctively Christian political body over which the Pope has, in effect, direct power in spiritual and in temporal matters. While for Gilson, Dante is guilty of the crime of separating church and state and thus shattering the unity of Christendom, on this view, Gilson's second crime in the political sphere is precisely to confuse the domains of church and state and to undermine thereby the Thomistic via media of potestas indirecta in temporalibus, which had been articulated anew in Pope Leo XIII's Immortali Dei of 1885. We can also see clearly how Gilson distorts Grabman's theory of medieval thought in order to cast Aquinas as a pure theologian, the champion of a unified Christian philosophy, and in Nietzsche, of a unified republic of Christian believers, and in polemical opposition, to cast Dante as a pure philosopher, the wrecker of Christian wisdom and of the unity of Christendom. What I have called the crime or the crimes of Gilson would exert an enormous and enduring influence on the history of Thomism and of Dante studies in the 20th century. Taking just Gilson's conception of Christian philosophy, allow me to give a Dominican example of its influence in each of these two fields. In Thomistic studies, the French Dominican Marie-Dominique Chenu came to see Étienne Gilson's Le Thomisme as the working tool of his whole generation. According to Chenu, Gilson understood well that the philosophy of St. Thomas was internal to his theology. We were always on the same path. In the 1920s, Chenu advocated for Gilson's closer involvement at the French Dominican House of Studies at Le Sauchoir, and once appointed regent of studies in 1934, he pursued a clearly Gilsonian agenda, directing its studies towards the history of primitive Thomism and away from scholastic or speculative theology. For Gilson, after all, quote, ever since the 13th century, which was the century of St. Thomas himself, the true meaning of the philosophy of St. Thomas had been lost. And he located this evil, especially at the beginning of the 20th century, in Western Europe, in the teaching of Catholic schools and among scholastics who considered themselves Thomists. On the feast day of St. Thomas in 1936, Chenu would echo Gilson's attack on the teaching of neo-scholastic philosophy and theology and develop Gilson's novel formulation of Christian philosophy into a new Dominican school of theology, Une École de Théologie de Sauchoir, published, of course, in 1937. This further entrenched the internalization of philosophy within theology and the confusion between them, which arguably became a feature of the so-called Nouvelle Théologie and of much subsequent Catholic thought as a whole. In Dante studies, the English Dominican Canon Foster, 1910 to 1979, uncritically adopted Gilson's conviction that Aquinas developed a new, distinctively Christian philosophy, a new metaphysical reform, as the very premise for his doctoral thesis. And in his scholarly career, Foster explicitly situated his approach to Dante in opposition to the Dominicans Mandone Cordovani and the lay Dominican Edward Bullo, who first introduced him to Dante at Cambridge, and as following the pioneering labours of Bruno Nardi and Étienne Gilson. Just as Gilson considered Dante a Latin Averroist and a pure philosopher, so Kenelm Foster's core claim was that there were two Dantes, the title of his seminal collection of essays of 1977. That is, Dante was caught between being a humanist, a lover of poetry and a philosopher, and a Christian, a lover of God and a theologian. Just as Gilson identified as the crime of Dante to ruin the unity of Christian wisdom by isolating faith from reason, so Kenelm Foster saw the dichotomy between Dante's two guides, Virgil and Beatrice, as creating a problematic separation between nature and grace, reason and faith, and philosophy and theology. What Gilson and Foster following him considers as the crime of Dante, or the evil of scholastics who call themselves Thomists, is arguably, however, just Thomism properly understood. After all, if on Foster's reckoning there are two Dantes, there are also, by the same logic, two Aquinases. Namely, Aquinas the philosopher, author, for example, of long commentaries on Aristotle, and Aquinas the theologian, author of the Summa Theologiae, and of course of many other theological works. Likewise, Dante's two guides, Virgil and Beatrice, are, from a traditional Thomistic perspective, simply his poetic solution to the challenge of representing in the speculative order of truth and knowledge the relative autonomy of truths from reason and truths from Revelation, which find in Christian theology, in Aquinas' Summa Theologiae, as in Dante's Divine Comedy, their integration without thereby losing their distinction. It was, nonetheless, Gilson's understanding of Dante and Aquinas, especially as mediated by Foster, that would form the scholarly consensus by the late 20th century, consolidated as it was, for example, by Foster's authorship of some of the most substantial and important articles of the seminal Encyclopedia Dantesca on theology, God, Christ, the Gospel, and on Aquinas himself. Let me now turn finally to Dante's Divine Comedy itself, and to Dante's own representation of St. Thomas in the Heaven of the Wise. As the papal Dominican Cordovani wryly remarked as early as 1921, if a few lines of praise devoted to Cedar Brabant could lead, in his view mistakenly, to the attribution of a great baggage of avaristic theories to our poet, what must we say of the three entire cantos of Paradiso, full of the glory of Thomas Aquinas, and in which he holds the truly sovereign place? The obvious interpretation of Dante's literary and, at an imaginative level, his visual privileging of Aquinas in the Heaven of the Sun, making him the leader of the first crown of theologians and endowing him with a marvellous lesson in the scientific method and in prudence for the discernment of truths in the fields of philosophy and of theology, is to signify the brilliance of his wisdom. Indeed, to no other character in the comedy, aside from its three central protagonists, Dante, Virgil, and Beatrice, does Dante afford as many lines as to St. Thomas Aquinas. In the concluding simile with which Aquinas finally departs the scene, Dante seems to imply, moreover, the perfect correspondence between Aquinas' doctrine and supernatural truth itself. Adopting a homely image, the concentric ripples of water created in a round bowl between the outer rim and the centre when the water is struck from outside, or from the centre to the outer rim when, like the thought that drops into Dante's mind, a pebble is dropped into its centre. Dante describes the perfect likeness between the speech of Aquinas, who is situated in the circumference of the first circle of the wise, and the speech of Beatrice, who is situated with Dante at its central point. Dal centro al cerchio e sì dal cerchio al centro, muovesi l'acqua in un ritondo vaso, secondo che è percosso fuori o dentro. Nella mia mente fe subito caso questo che io dico, sì come si tacque la gloriosa vita di Tommaso, per la similitudine che nacque del suo parlar e di quel di Beatrice. Even Etienne Gilson recognizes that this passage at first appears a quite decisive argument in support of the fundamental Thomism of Dante, establishing that Dante considered Thomistic theology and faith to be hardly distinguishable. And yet, as Gilson continues in his monograph, Dante and Philosophy, to unpick the arguments of Mandonet's Dante the Theologian one by one, Gilson claims that even this argument is in fact fantastic, utterly irrelevant, incoherent, and built on sand. He doesn't mince his words. While Gilson claims to put these lines back in their context and to restore Dante and Beatrice to the positions which Dante allotted to them at the beginning of Paradiso Canto 14, Mandonet, however, had already stated clearly that Beatrice occupies the centre and, in the crown which immediately surrounds her, St. Thomas occupies the preeminent place. Gilson relies on a false antinomy, therefore, As Mandonnet does not deny the literal significance of the analogy, as Gilson implies, but rather gives it a symbolical interpretation, which is also the majority reading of these lines in the early commentary tradition. A final response to Gilson's critique, moreover, may be that Dante probably derived this very image from his reading of Aquinas' commentary on De Anima, on the soul, one of the most disputed philosophical texts of the time, not least with respect to the Averroes view on the unicity of the potential intellect. Nothing would be more fitting, convenience perhaps, than that Dante might thus have taken a simile from his study of Aquinas' philosophy to illustrate the perfect relationship between Aquinas' doctrine and supernatural truth. Conclusion. In his encyclical, Eterni Patris of 1879, Pope Leo XIII exhorts his bishops across the world in all earnestness to restore the golden wisdom of St. Thomas and to spread it far and wide for the defence and beauty of the Catholic faith, for the good of society and for the advantages of all sciences. Let the universities already founded or to be founded by you, he goes on, illustrate and defend this doctrine and use it for the refutation of prevailing errors. And yet, Pope Leo XIII also issues a warning. But lest the false for the true or the corrupt for the pure be drunk in, be watchful that the doctrine of Thomas be drawn from his own fountains, or at least from those rivulets which, derived from the very fount, have thus far flowed, according to the established agreement of learned men, pure and clear. Be careful to guard the minds of youth from those which are said to flow thence, but in reality are gathered from strange and unwholesome streams. In this talk, I have argued that one such strange and unwholesome stream is, at least in two core respects, the deeply influential Thomism of Etienne Gilson. I have accused Gilson, indeed, of two crimes against Thomism, crimes which lead him, in turn, to falsely accuse Dante of striking at Thomism a mortal blow. Defending Dante against such a crime, I have retrieved the established agreement of learned men of the Leonine Thomistic revival, arguing that Dante's works, and preeminently the Commedia, are instead a true rivulet of the doctrine of Thomas, which, derived from the very fount, has indeed flowed pure and clear before being contaminated over the course of the 20th century. Purified and restored anew, I hope that many may find again in Dante's Divine Comedy, in the words of Impre Claris Humorum, a treasure of Catholic teaching, the essence of Christian philosophy and theology, and even the compendium of the divine laws which should govern the constitution and administration of states. As Pope Benedict XV exhorts at the conclusion of his encyclical, the more you grow in love for Dante, the more perfectly your souls will be irradiated by the splendour of truth, and the more steadfast you will remain in your devotion and service to the Holy Faith. With an American Pope, Leo XIV, who in taking that name explicitly looked back to Pope Leo XIII, I hope that by likewise looking back for inspiration to the remarkable scholarly era ushered in by Pope Leo XIII, we may witness in the coming quarter century not only a second Leonine Renaissance of Thomism, but also a second Leonine Renaissance of Dante studies as well. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this lecture on the Thomistic Institute podcast. The generosity of people like you makes this podcast possible. If you enjoy these talks, please consider showing your support at www.thomisticinstitute.org/donate. Your donation of even a dollar helps us reach more college students and many others with the powerful truths of the faith, and it ensures that we can keep publishing top-notch lectures on this podcast. Thanks a lot.